So often I play a game with my students when I start a new topic. We're going to try it very quickly now. It's called word association. I call it a game because I work with children. It's not a game. It's not fun. I just call it a game to make it sound like they're having some fun. All I do is I put a word on the screen, on the board, and they have to say the very first word that comes into their head. A gut reaction. What is the very first thing that arrives in your mind after you see this word? So I'm going to play it with you now. It's a way of getting our heads into one of the main themes of 1 Samuel chapter 4. You don't need to write anything down. You can tell the person next to you the word. It'd be interesting to see whether you get similar things to people around you. And the word, if my clicker works, is glory. Talk to each other. Gut reaction, first word. I wonder if you are as good as thesaurus.com. Thesaurus.com thinks you will have come up with things like this. You may not be able to see those there. I'll read a few examples for you. Glory, says thesaurus.com, is grandeur, greatness, reputation, splendor, triumph, illustriousness. Did anyone come up with illustriousness? No. But you get the idea. This word glory is a very powerful word. You may prefer to think of it in other ways. So, for example, you may think of royal power. That could be something which symbolizes glory for us. This is Queen Elizabeth II at the point of her coronation. Maybe royal power makes you think of glory. Maybe glory, you think of military victories, glorious battles. Those kinds of things sometimes come with the word glory. What about a sporting victory? This is Katarina Johnson Thompson, won the gold medal in the heptathlon not that long ago after all those years of work, and she won. And she's the best in the world at seven sports rolled into one. That's quite a glorious thing. Maybe you're more into the natural world, and maybe that's what you think of when you think of glory. The stars, a canopy of stars, the billions of stars in the universe, the amazing mountains that we see on Earth. Sunrises, sunsets, maybe when you hear the word glory, those are the kind of things that you think. Now, the Bible tells us that God is glorious. And there's a few, you can pick out hundreds of verses. Here are a couple. So 1 Chronicles 29 verse 11 says, "Yours, O Lord, is the greatness and the power and the glory and the victory and the majesty." They should have come up with those on thesaurus.com, shouldn't they? "For all that is in the heavens and in the earth is yours. Yours is the kingdom, O Lord, and you are exalted as head above all." That's God's glory. What about this one? Psalm 19, verse 1. "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims his handiwork." Glory is one of the themes of the passage that we had read to us just now and that we're going to be referring back to. One of the central questions that we're thinking about this morning is, if God is glorious, and if glory is the things we've thought about just now, then how do we respond to God's glory? What's our response to that amazing glory of God? It's a question for us because it's a question for the people in our passage. So if you've been here in recent weeks, you'll know we're looking through 1 Samuel, the book of 1 Samuel, and it's the story of a people who know full well what God's glory is like, but they decide that God, in all his glory, is not enough for them. They reject God, they turn their backs on him, and this leads to the chapter we have today, 1 Samuel chapter 4, which is pretty dark, isn't it? Pretty dark chapter, a chapter of judgment. And because it's dark, I thought I'd at least cheer you up by making my main points rhyme. So we will be looking at the way they treat God, which I've branded as scorning glory. We get that word from actually slightly earlier when God says, "Why do you scorn my sacrifice?" It's in chapter 2. So scorning glory. And then we're going to think about the results of that, the judgment, which leads to them mourning glory. For those listening online, that's mourning with a U, the bad one, not the one when the day begins. So, scorning glory and then mourning glory. I hope that will at least help you see where we're at as we go through. So first, let's think about the way they have scorned the glory of God. So verse 1 of our chapter today, if you look back just above the chapter heading in the Bibles in front of you, if you've got a church Bible, you'll see there is another verse just above that. The first tiny little snippet of verse 1 says, "And Samuel's word came to all Israel." And then it goes on to the passage as we heard it earlier. And for those who missed last week's sermon, that word, Samuel's word that comes to all Israel, is a word of devastating judgment, a foretelling, a prophecy of awful judgment on Eli and his family. And that judgment comes from the way they were scorning God's glory. And it happens in three ways. There's three different ways we see the scorning happen. The first one is that actually, you go back a bit further, you see the whole nation of Israel at this time is scorning God's kingship. They are scorning his kingship. They are chosen by him, the Old Testament tells us, his special people. They are rescued by him, and they are blessed by him. And they decide that he's not enough for them. They decide they don't want God as their king. They want their own king. They want to do things their own way. And the end of the book of Judges, which chronologically sets 1 Samuel up, says there was no king and everyone did as he saw fit. They scorned God's kingship. The second way is that they are scorning God's salvation. So the spiritual leader of the nation, Eli, has let his rogue sons, Hophni and Phinehas, who we heard mentioned in our chapter today, run rampant in the temple. The Bible literally calls them scoundrels. I haven't counted, but I don't know how many other times you get that word in the Bible. They are scoundrels, these two. And they are really nasty pieces of work. They are sexual predators, and they eat from the meat that was presented as a sacrifice to God. They do it just to satisfy their greedy stomachs. And if you remember from previous weeks, that is not just some cheeky theft from temple supplies. When they eat the meat that was meant for sacrifice to God, they are scorning the only way that God has given them to be forgiven. They are pouring scorn on that system of sacrifices, like a drowning swimmer who pushes away a lifeguard and laughs in his face. They are pushing away the only thing that can rescue them. Now, that's what brings us to 1 Samuel chapter 4. They've scorned God's kingship. They've scorned his offer of salvation. And then we get this terrible judgment starting to be acted out. So if you look down again at verse 1 and verses 2, we see that the Israelites go out to fight against the Philistines. And then in verse 2, we find they are badly defeated. This is a heavy military defeat for them. Now, even they, keep your eyes down at verse 3, even they can see that this is God's doing. The elders ask, why did the Lord bring defeat on us? Now, that's a little bit of an odd question to ask, isn't it? Look at chapter 4, verse 1. Samuel's word came to all Israel. They know. They've been told that this judgment is coming. And even if they hadn't been told, they might have worked it out from the behavior of their priests in the temple. But they don't get it. They don't see that. And their response, actually, to why did the Lord bring this defeat on us, shows us even more how far lost they are as a nation. What do they do? Have a look at verse 3. Let's go and get the ark of the Lord's covenant. Let's go back to Shiloh where the ark is. Let's bring the ark that he may go with us and save us from the hand of our enemies. Now, it might be worth us just thinking about what that really means. So the ark was a symbol with the Israelites of God's presence with them. Here's what it might have looked like. If you've never seen it, it's described in some detail in earlier parts of the Bible. So it's a gold-plated box, but it carries with it enormous religious significance for God's people. Specifically, I found it helpful when I was reading in preparation for this, you can break it down into three particular ways in which it signifies God being with them. So it signifies God's revelation to them. You remember that in the ark, the Ten Commandments are there. So God's revealed himself, and that's in the ark, the Ten Commandments on the stone tablets. It symbolizes God's rule. You see the way it's described in verse 4 here, the ark of the covenant of the Lord of hosts who is enthroned. So it represents God's rule over them. And it also represents God's relationship with them. Part of the ark, something called the mercy seat, was the place of atonement. It was the place that was sprinkled once a year with a blood sacrifice so that the sins of the people didn't need to be a barrier between them and God. So it's a symbol of their God's revelation to the people, his rule over the people, and his relationship with the people. That's what the ark is. If that's what the ark is, isn't it bizarre that they think it's a good idea to go and get it? Now, the reason I say that is because let's think about where they're at as a nation. They are scorning his rule. They don't want it. They say, we want our own kind of king. We don't want your rule. So they're scorning that. They're scorning his revelation. They're not living according to the way he told them to live, as was revealed in the Ten Commandments. And we've seen their priests are pouring scorn on God's means of relating to them through the system of sacrifices. They don't see that by getting the ark, all they're doing is treating it as some kind of lucky charm. This is lucky charm faith that they're engaged in here. Even the Philistines, did you see this? Even the Philistines, their pagan enemies, get it more than they do. Look in verse 8, we're doomed. Who will save us from the hand of these mighty gods? And then it recounts some of Israel's history. But what neither the Philistines or the Israelites see is that by getting the ark and treating it as a lucky charm, all they're doing is heaping down more condemnation on themselves. They are making all the more plain how much they've lost sight of God's rule, his revelation, and his relationship with them. Think about how they're living. God's rule scorned by their behavior. His revelation to them scorned by the way they live, and his means of relationship scorned. Everything the ark symbolizes is scorned, and yet they go and get it as if God owed them something. We'll bring this down, and then God will come and deliver us. Now, in case we missed the point, the narrator rams it home. I reckon if you were asked to name the dynamic duo in this book of the Bible who you might describe as the most offensive, most vulgar, most God-scorning characters in 1 Samuel, we'd all come up with the same two names. And look down at verse 4. Who is it who comes swaggering out with the ark as if it owed them something? Hophni and Phinehas. Now I wonder if it's worth another pause here. I wonder where you see yourself in this sorry tale. We have been thinking in recent weeks how we're quite quick to read ourselves into the heroes in the Bible. We're quite quick to say, oh, we're Samuel, right? So there we are. We're not involved in this mess. We're praying back at the temple in Shiloh. We love to think that we're distanced from the dirt. And what do you think? Maybe let's run through the options. We can't be the Israelites, can we? The people who are scorning God's kingship and living as if they're in charge of their own lives? No, we'd never do a thing like that. Maybe Hophni and Phinehas? No, not the scoundrels who scorn God's offer of forgiveness. Maybe Eli? Surely not. The spiritually blind old man, too weak to stand up for what's right? No, we can't be Eli, can we? Folks, let me suggest that we are both much too quick to read ourselves into the positions of the heroes and much too slow to read ourselves into the positions of the less savory characters in the Bible. Maybe I should hold up my hands and say, I think if I had been there, I'd love to think I would have been Samuel in the temple, but I'd probably have been out with the rest of the Israelites, heaping condemnation down on myself, thinking I was doing the right thing, but actually walking away from God. That's often the position of our hearts, isn't it? I think if we think hard, and again, let me personalize it, I scorn God's kingship in my life every time I make choices that put me before him, every time I make choices that reject his rule. I effectively scorn God's offer of salvation every time I, a Christian trusting that Christ has died to save me, forget that truth and go on to sin again and again and again. Let me stand in front of you now and say that I scorn God's presence every time I use religion for my own ends. Every time I read the Bible or pray or sing songs of worship, not because I want to be in his presence, but because I'm ticking some religious boxes to make me feel better. Some part of me deep inside believes, maybe like the Israelites, that somehow he'll owe me something. If I do these things, maybe my life will go a little bit better. Every time my heart leads me down that path, I scorn God's presence. The natural position of our hearts is scorning God's glory. So the logical question is, what are the consequences of that? And that's what we're going to think about now as we observe the way that the Israelites end up mourning glory. See, the consequence of the scorn is that they end up separated from that glory. And when you take away all those words that thesaurus.com gave us, grandeur, splendor, majesty, when you take away those things, it's like taking away light. You're left with nothing but darkness. And we can see this in verse 10. If you keep your eyes down, the Israelites scorn God's glory by abusing the ark as a lucky charm, and the judgment just escalates. Look in verse 10. So every man fled his tent. The slaughter was very great. Israel lost 30,000 foot soldiers. The ark of God was captured, and Eli's two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, died. A comprehensive defeat, right? And then we get to Eli, verses 12 to 18. Just picture the old man Eli sat by the side of the road. Why is he sat by the side of the road? Because he can't do anything else. He's helpless at this point in his life. He's blind. He's lost his spiritual direction. He can't do anything else. Remember when we met him in chapter 1, verse 9? He was Eli, the priest. And now the Bible just calls him plain old Eli. And it says that his heart was trembling with fear. We don't often get descriptions of emotion in the Old Testament, so that stands out. His heart was trembling with fear. He's old and he's weak, but here's the crucial question. What exactly kills Eli in verse 18? Does he die mourning the news that the Israelites have fled? Does he die mourning the news that the army has suffered heavy losses? Does he die mourning the death of his two sons? Now, verse 18 makes it clear that it was when the messenger mentioned the ark of God, Eli fell backwards off his chair by the side of the gate. His neck was broken and he died. Eli dies mourning the news that the ark, that symbol of God's revelation, his rule and his relationship, is taken away from the people of Israel. Eli dies mourning the separation of God's glory from his people. God's glory is gone. Eli knows it, and the news kills him. I wonder if we understand how serious it is to be separated from the glory of God. This small part of this passage even shows us it's more serious than the fleeing of an army. It's more serious than the defeat of a nation. It's more serious and personal than the death of two sons. And Eli's not the only one who sees it. Look at 19 and 20. Phinehas' heavily pregnant wife is sent into labor by the news of the loss of the ark and the death of her husband, gives birth to a son, dies in the process, but before she dies, she names the boy. And what does she name him? Does she call him Phinehas after her late husband as a memorial to the man of her life? Does she call him Eli after her great nation-famous priest father-in-law? She calls him Ichabod, which literally means, in the little footnote at the bottom there, no glory. And in verse 22, she explains her dark choice of name. She says, "The glory has departed from Israel, for the ark of God has been captured." She doesn't die lamenting her own coming death. She doesn't die even mourning her husband's death. She dies mourning the separation from God's glory. And folks, this really matters, because if we are as guilty as God's people, then this is our situation too. Think back to those words on the screen at the start. All that glory is, if we are like the Israelites, then without hope and without help, our position is one of mourning glory too. Separation from all that stuff that was so good. I told you it was a pretty dark passage. And you may well find yourself asking this morning, especially if you haven't been here in previous weeks, where is the hope in this? We've seen ourselves in the way they're scorning glory. We've seen ourselves in the way they are mourning glory, the consequences of that. But if we stop there, then we miss the heart of 1 Samuel. We miss the core of this book. Because this book carries a forecast, even in the darkness of judgment, of God's dawning glory too. There's something coming. There's a sense of hope. And so that's where we're going to move towards our close. You see, 1 Samuel 4 is about judgment and darkness, but, and here's the amazing thing, it's exactly in that darkness that there is a glimmer of hope. And I'll show you why. There's three proofs we get of that from 1 Samuel. So we have to think back a little bit. The first one, you'll remember Hannah's song when Samuel is born. There's dawning glory in that song, and it gives us proof that there's dawning glory in 1 Samuel 4 too, because some of the what she sings in chapter 2, I'll read you some of the references. She says, "The Lord is a God who knows, and by him deeds are weighed." That's judgment. "The bows of the warriors are broken. The Lord brings death. He brings down to the grave." Those are some of the things that Hannah sings in her song. So it foretells some of that darkness in chapter 4, but she doesn't just sing those things. She sings in the very same breath brilliant songs of hope too. So she says, "The Lord brings death and makes alive. He brings down to the grave and raises up." And so when we see the darkness coming true in chapter 4, that's a prompt for us to think that the hope is coming true too. The darkness in itself is a sign of the promised hope being on its way. Proof number two. So in the second half of chapter 2, there's someone called the man of God who brings another prophecy of judgment. It's his prophecy where we get that word scorn. Through him, God says, "Why do you scorn my sacrifice? No one in your family will reach old age," talking to Eli's family, "and your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, will both die on the same day." Is that what happened? 1 Samuel chapter 4, Hophni and Phinehas die on the same day. So their death, which is specifically confirmed for us in chapter 4, proves that the man of God's prophecy is coming true. But if it proves that the prophesied judgment is coming true, then it also proves the promise of hope that the man's prophecy contained too. And again, I'll read you a few bits of this from the second half of chapter 2. He says, "They will both die on the same day." And then God says through the man of God, through his prophecy, "I will raise up for myself a priest who will do according to what is in my heart and mind. I will establish his priestly house, and they will minister before my anointed one always." So the death of Hophni and Phinehas confirms both the judgment and that the promise of hope is coming too. So the darkness itself that we see in chapter 4 is a sign that the promised hope is on the way. There's one final one. There's one final piece of proof in Samuel that this awful chapter of judgment is not random or accidental, but is pre-planned. And the proof is Samuel himself. So last week we looked at Samuel chapter 3. "The Lord said to Samuel, 'See, I am about to do something in Israel that will make the ears of everyone who hears about it tingle. At that time I will carry out against Eli everything I spoke against his family from beginning to end. For I told Eli that I would judge his family forever.'" So Samuel himself doesn't appear in our chapter today, but it starts with Samuel's word coming to all Israel. So this chapter 4 is not accidental darkness, but pre-planned judgment. And it is therefore evidence that God is not absent. Imagine how the Israelites must have felt. Where's God? God is not absent. He is firmly at the wheel. To put it simply, you are not reading the book of 1 Ichabod. That would have been a really, really different story to read the book of 1 Ichabod. This is the book of 1 Samuel, a boy whose very name points to the fact that God speaks dawning glory into our darkness. And the narrator of 1 Samuel is desperate that we don't miss this. He's desperate that we don't miss that pattern, that the darkness itself is a sign that the promised hope is on the way. And the reason he's so desperate that we don't miss it is that there's another place where that pattern shines through. So there's another place where, instead of glorious victory that God's people expected, we get a humiliating and crushing and inglorious defeat, or so it seemed at that moment. There's another place where we see a stunning rejection of everything that the ark had represented, the revelation, the rule, and the relationship rejected. Now, in the Old Testament, the symbol of that relationship, the rule, and the revelation is the ark. In the New Testament, God chooses another way to do things. He chooses another way to reveal himself to us. He chooses another way to rule us. He gives us another king, and he chooses another way for us to relate to him. John 1, verse 14, we had a bit of John read to us earlier. Here's another verse from that same chapter. It says, "The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory." We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. God's plan, right from the very start, was to reveal himself to us, to rule us, and to relate to us through his glorious Son, Jesus. But just like in 1 Samuel 4, where God's people expect a glorious victory, an amazing triumphant rescue, before that comes, the dawning of God's glorious hope in Jesus was preceded by the scorning of glory and the most mournful of judgment days. In Matthew chapter 27, it puts it like this: "The chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders mocked him. 'He saved others,' they said, 'but he can't save himself. He's the king of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross, and we will believe in him. He trusts in God. Let God rescue him now if he wants him. For he said, 'I am the Son of God.'" In the same way, the rebels who were crucified with him also heaped insults on him. "From noon until 3 PM, darkness came over the land. About 3 PM, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, 'My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?'" Now, you'll see in future weeks, please come back, because the story of 1 Samuel doesn't end with the loss of the ark and the separation from God's glory. There's so much more to come, but I don't want you to leave the room this morning without knowing or remembering that Jesus' death on the cross is not the end either. It's not accidental darkness. It's pre-planned darkness that was in itself a sign that the promised hope is coming too. Jesus, in that darkness, took the judgment that my scorn earns me and your scorn earns you, so that we might know there's no judgment left to fear. On the cross, Jesus himself, the Son of God, was separated from God's glory so that we would never have to be. And how can we truly know? Because 3 days later, Hannah's song echoes around Jesus' tomb. In 1 Samuel, Hannah sings, "The Lord brings death and makes alive. He brings down to the grave, but he also raises up." And why does that matter? The book of Hebrews is fantastic on this. And chapter 7, verse 24 puts it like this: "Because Jesus lives forever, he has a permanent priesthood. Therefore, he is able to save completely those who come to God through him." The fact of the darkness on the cross was in itself a sign of the promised hope that has now come, that is now ours, if only we'll accept it. And so we arrive back at our central question. If glory is everything that we saw at the start, and if God is glorious and Jesus is the ultimate glory, how do we respond to him? I'm going to pause before we sing our last song and leave you a few moments just to consider those three questions. And they are these: in what ways might I be scorning God's glory? How can I better understand the tragic mourning of being separated from God's glory? And finally, have I seen for myself, or do I need reminding maybe today, of God's dawning glory in Jesus Christ? and what that means for me. Father God, please give us eyes to see who we are before you. Please help us to see how we are scorning your glory in the different ways that we live. Please help us to understand what it would mean to be separated forever from your glory. And please help us to see how glorious it is that you sent Jesus to die for us so that we need never be separated from you. We ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen.